Support for this KQED podcast comes from Bay Meadows, an urban village in San Mateo. Fitness and movies in the park, Caltrain, artisan eateries, fun for the kids, all just a hop from your front door. Homes now selling and leasing. BayMeadows.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's Forum program, as a national correspondent for The Atlantic, James Fallows often focuses on the international stage, subjects such as China, the Middle East, the United States military. But recently, Fallows, who grew up in California, has turned his attention to his home state. He joins us to talk about key infrastructure decisions facing California, including high-speed rail and water distribution. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. James Fallows still calls himself a Californian, even though he has lived in many places, including China. The national correspondent for The Atlantic, he is former editor of U.S. News and World Report and was President Jimmy Carter's young chief speechwriter. The author of numerous books, including most recently China Airborne. His work has appeared in Slate, New York Times Magazine, New York Review of Books, and The New Yorker, and he has been visiting professor at a number of universities, including UC Berkeley. For his America's Future project, he has been traveling the country, reporting on the people, groups, and ideas reshaping the country. And he joins us this hour to talk about his recent articles on California's Central Valley and the challenges facing this state's infrastructure. And as I said to him before we went on air, he's been somewhat California-centric in these articles in The Atlantic. And Jim, welcome back to the Forum program.
Michael, it is a great pleasure to be here. I listen to you across the country. I've enjoyed being here over the years, so thanks for having me today.
Delighted to have you. Not delighted to start off with a subject, though, that I feel needs some attention. I'm really interested in getting your take on. We're going to talk about California, as I said, and many other things, I hope, in the course of this hour. Always interested in how you see things. But you did write in The Atlantic about what happened in Roseburg and the recent killings, and came to the kind of conclusion that these in-home-grown killings, as you call them, have just become part of our natural headlines and something that we have to rock with and take the horrors as they come. But also there were some suggestions in there about, since we don't seem to be able to do much about the archaic, as you call it, Second Amendment, some suggestions about maybe liability and ways of at least making it harder to buy a gun legally.
I think there are two points in this horrible topic worth starting with. One is, as you know from traveling around the world, as I know from living around the world, and as many of the listeners know, this is one of the dark sides of the generally positive American exceptionalism. This sort of thing just doesn't happen in other countries. And by this sort of thing, I mean repeated, routinized mass shootings. And it's in Australia is now famous. They had one terrible episode in Tasmania with 35 people murdered, and they just changed their gun laws after that. And it hasn't happened to anything like the scale of that sort. So it's worth recognizing this is not a universal human trait. This is an American defect now. The other is when President Obama gave his latest press conference right after the shootings, I thought that his tone of angry disgust was exactly right, because it's so easy for politicians to say our prayers and thoughts go to everybody affected by this tragedy and just move on. He was saying correctly, people will blame me for politicizing this, but every time this happens, his own resignation, I'm going to remind us this is something we jointly politically decide not to fix. Now, whether it's possible to politically fix is a whole different question, but I thought that was the right tone for him to strike. The solutions that people have in mind involve, I think, indirect ones like controlling large capacity magazines or liability for gun makers or whatever, because it's sort of a direct with so many guns already in existence, you're not going to get rid of them, but some way to try to bend the curve.
And those ways may bend it slightly, but it's a big curve that we're dealing with here, a huge one. In fact, when you mentioned magazines, what do you, I'm interested, you know, as a lifetime journalist, what you think about the argument that, well, for example, the Washington Post, I believe, and certainly the New York Times has now elected not to name these shooters, and yet you get the argument, First Amendment, and people should get the full story and so forth. But there does tend to be almost a glorification, at least in the minds of some of these people who are going to err this way or move this way.
It's true. I remember two or three days ago, the print version of the New York Times, which I saw when I was in Washington before coming here, had its lead story in the upper right-hand column was experts fear glorification of shooter. And then there was a picture of the shooter with his name. And so it was sort of the contradictions of trying to deal with these things. And it's true that the person, this guy and the guy in Aurora and all the other streams of youngish, disturbed, mainly white, overwhelmingly men, the only way their names are ever known to history is through this sort of outburst and outrage. There is nothing.
And now the manifesto has come forward.
Yes,
here too,
yes.
Which turns out he didn't have a girlfriend and things of this sort.
Like the guy in Santa Barbara. And it is, I mean, the horror is we know that I did a list at the Atlantic of all the mass shootings since Aurora, and 2/3 of them I'd forgotten. And I think most people would have forgotten just because there will be another one next month and another one 6 months after that. And that is the hideous reality of what of a political decision we're not able to change.
Which, in a strange way, maybe moves to the long now. We've got a long now with these kinds of killings. And you're on board in this. Well, it's been a long-time project since Stuart Brown started it.
Yes.
So, you're excited about it. Tell us what it is.
Am.
A lot of people don't know about
so
the long now.
Stuart Brown is one of the real pioneers of just public thinking and technological thinking over the last generation or two.
The Whole Earth Catalog.
The Whole Earth Catalog was how I first came to know him back in the 1960s when I was in college and he was getting this going. And he's been somebody who has been always on the frontier of thinking both optimistically and critically about technology and how about it fits into the other parts of our life arc. And the long now is thinking now about the consequences 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, 500,000 years from now of the choices we're making. And so a couple of months ago, he asked me to come speak at one of the sessions this evening, which I was telling you off microphone, this is the unusual circumstance where I really had to think about what I'm going to say. It's not a normal sort of stump speech, but I've been thinking about his charge to talk about the infrastructure that makes civilization possible and what that now means in a place like California and a country like America at this stage of history. So that's what I'll talk about tonight.
Well, you're also going to talk with us about California because you've been writing a lot about California. And I read with great interest a piece you did about San Bernardino and how it has had misfortune and political dysfunction now, loss of blue-collar labor, police and firefighters doing pretty well for the most part, but the city not doing well. Brings up this whole question, and I want to talk about Fresno, too, because you write about Fresno, and it's a fascinating case in point, about cities in California that are going bankrupt. I mean, Vallejo, Stockton, and so forth, for similar kinds of circumstances that have to do with just not having enough sustainable revenue.
Yes, and let me give just a few words of background here. For the last 2 years now, my wife Deb and I have been traveling around the country, you know, for the Atlantic in our little propeller airplane, looking at cities that have faced some kind of challenge and how they've dealt with it. San Bernardino, which is right next door to the city where I grew up. The city where I grew up is Redlands in Southern California, San Bernardino County. San Bernardino is, in a way, the most troubled city in California, arguably the country, because of a combination of economic shocks it had. The Air Force Base closed, the railroad yards moved, Interstate 15 even moved. It had gone through San Bernardino, but moved west to wherever it is, Ontario, it goes through now. And it was not simply those economic shocks, but genuine political dysfunction built into the town. So it was not able to address these problems in the way a lot of other places, including Fresno and including ones we've seen in South Dakota and South Carolina and Mississippi, have been able to. And that's what's interesting in the larger California sense, because I think 10 years ago, many people thought that California had a great economy and a dysfunctional government, sort of a metaphor for our country. And I think California is seen now as having a more functional state government for all of the gripes that locals will have about taxes and all the rest. So that was the context in which we saw San Bernardino.
And then you write about Fresno as being in a winner state but always perceived as a loser city. And the truth of the matter is it's a great time to be an artist in Fresno. I mean, all the artists have to move out of San Francisco. They can't afford to live here. In Fresno, you can actually afford to live.
One of the themes we found across the country is the motivating power of knowing that you are looked down on. Mississippi knows is looked down on by everybody, and Arkansas knows it's looked down on by everybody except Mississippi. And this has kind of driving power. Fresno is aware of its image from the big coastal cities of California, and they've used it as a motivation to say, okay, our downtown is really ruined, where we look as if we had all sorts of troubles, but we're going to have a sort of multi-front approach to making this a happening city. And they have a genuine art scene there, which, as you say, is based on affordable real estate. If you can't afford anymore in San Francisco to have some kind of art studio, but you can do it in Fresno and have a sort of side life, too. So I'm a big fan of Fresno, its mayor, Ashley Swearingen, and the people there who are bringing the place back.
This arts festival there has been running a number of years, and it's in the Tower District, and we have a lot of Fresno listeners, so they can talk about their pride in this. But it's a kind of bohemia that San Francisco is losing, really.
It's one of the dilemmas. I was talking last night with a bunch of San Francisco tech people, and there are all these challenges that San Francisco now has as a consequence of its phenomenal success. And of course, these are a high class of problems, but they're still problems. You know, different problems from what Detroit has or Toledo or some other places, but still problems. But it does create opportunities for some of those places in the other parts of the state where real estate is notably cheap, where you can live without commuting for hours and hours. One other Fresno anecdote, a man there who's in charge of the Rogue Festival was saying that he can have in L.A., he might have to commute for, you know, an hour each way. In Fresno, it's a 5-minute commute, and he has that much more time in his day to be an artist and to just live a normal life and in a way that's not possible in the big metropolises.
And a civic recovery.
Yes, indeed. So I encourage everybody, all of the listeners either in Fresno or considering going to Fresno, to look at the Fulton Street Mall downtown. That's something that 50 plus years ago was one of the innovative American car-free malls. And they found after a while that just didn't work. Excuse me. If you closed off streets to traffic, people didn't come anymore. So they're having an ambitious plan to reopen it to sort of limited traffic. And a lot of the attention of America's urban developers now is looking at Fresno and the way they're trying to redo this whole part of their city.
Our guest is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of China Airborne, among many other books. Well, speaking about a 5-minute commute, you're on board on Governor Brown's, some people call the train to nowhere. Boy, it gets more barbs and satire. People are going to take you on this and push back, but you've become a big fan of it. In fact, you compare it to the Erie Canal and the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yes.
And the highway system.
I will stipulate that I'm not living in California now, although I spent most of last winter based in Redlands, my hometown, and traveling up and down the Central Valley. But I still think of myself as a loyal little citizen here. And I think this will be seen. It's more likely that 50 or 80 years from now, people will see this as a very wise, big, risky, controversial bet than see it as some kind of boondoggle. It certainly is true that in the history of American public infrastructure, there have been some mistakes. Robert Moses with bulldozing much of New York, some of the urban redevelopment in Boston and other cities. But I argue that almost every project we now look on as just indispensable for the fabric of our nation, the Panama Canal, the Erie Canal, some of the railroads, the Golden Gate Bridge, the water projects in California, the GI Bill, anything you name that is part of who we are now, when it was under consideration, buying Alaska. These were all
Seward's folly.
Yeah. They said, you know, this is a boondoggle. It's never going to work because it is so much easier to imagine the cost in the short term than it is to imagine the long-term growth that will come from this infrastructure. So based on what I've seen, I would put the high-speed rail project in that category and not in the Robert Moses mistaken urban redevelopment category.
Well, we'll certainly hear from listeners on that. We'll hear from listeners on Fresno. But listeners should be apprised of the fact that they can go to the ESRI map, and that's put out by UC Davis. Talk about that, because you have the whole thing available in Atlantic and online. It's available online.
One of the tools that we've been using while traveling around the country is to try to have some geographically based explanations of things we're seeing. Because with the new world of mapping software, largely pioneered by this company, ESRI, from my original hometown of Redlands, and there's a very carefully crafted one that Esri technologists and people at UC Davis put together to show different aspects of the high-speed rail project. For example, the fact that the Central Valley, where the original legs, i.e. nowhere, of the train will go through, that they're the highest unemployment zones of California. I think most Californians don't realize that if the plan to break the state up into six states went through, which it won't, but if that happened, the state of Central California would be the poorest state in the union. It would be poorer than Mississippi, poorer than Arkansas. I think richer than Puerto Rico, but you know, in that bracket. It's poor. It's most polluted. It's neediest in every way. And again, part of the argument is that this would be part of the recovery of that part of the state and then eventually a trunk to link the state together.
If you do high-speed rail, you're going to have to pave over farmland, no?
One of the arguments the maps help illustrate is a compared to what question, or a compared with what question, as the grammarians would put it. Farmland has been much more farmland is being lost to sprawl and to highways than would be foreclosed or eminent domain for these railroad tracks. So, again, not presenting myself as an independent expert, but having listened to the presentations of the Central Valley with and without the high-speed rail project, the argument for the rail people, which is convincing to me, is that you're going to preserve more of the farmland with a rail system than you would with more malls, more freeways, more suburbia.
Since we're talking about California, California, well, water distribution, you have some ideas? Please, share them.
I recognize the complexity of this issue and the gravity of the threat facing the state. When I was a kid in Southern California in the 60s, we had a series of droughts, but obviously nothing like this. All I can say is that in one more way, I think California can be setting an example for the rest of the country. This is the most populous state, of course. Something like one American in nine lives here. And so showing the way in which the country can face the reality of climate change-driven shifts in the realities of our operations, that is as far as I can go. I don't know enough about the big water projects to compare them, but it is a genuine challenge, and we are all in this together.
Again, we're talking to Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of China Airborne. Let me just get back for a moment to Fresno, because you write a lot about this Bitwise and seem to be pretty enthusiastic.
In my last few visits to—
Tell us what it is first.
So Bitwise is a tech startup makerspace in Fresno. And I'll give a bit of background here. So starting about 3 years ago, I was living in China starting 10 years ago for a number of years. And there, of course, we saw all the manufacturing concentration in China. But a man that I wrote about often in China named Liam Casey, who was one of the sort of champions of outsourcing manufacturing to China, 3 or 4 years ago, he came to San Francisco saying that the United States was actually going to be the next center of urban manufacturing, that being close to the market, being able to respond very quickly using 3D printing and all the rest, that was going to be the next phase. He has a sort of incubator here called Highway 1. There are all sorts of famous ones, Tech Shop and the rest. And across the country in places like Fresno, you have places that is called Bitwise, where they're trying to be an incubator for people who want to have startups related to Fresno strength, which is agriculture, of having big data projects or monitoring projects. And we've seen these in South Dakota and South Carolina and Mississippi and Minnesota and all the rest. So they become frequent in San Francisco, but Bitwise is an illustration of what's happening in Fresno, too.
Again, we're talking to Jim Fallows, and I said we range around a lot because I'm always interested in what he has to say, not only about California, but you know, he was head of U.S. News and World Report for years and a real thinker and somebody who I like to hear reflect on different. What do you think about the trade deal that's just the TPP? It's just gone through.
I will choose my words carefully here.
You usually do.
I think that trade deals on balance have done more good than bad for the United States. The bad of them is obvious in that in every country of the world, the disruptive effects of globalization are being felt. Every country has the same problems we do of extremes of income and of wealth. Every country has dislocation of labor movement, even China. You know, this is a worldwide phenomenon. And so we recognize that globalization accelerates these things. My sense is there are more benefits for the United States in particular in this than there are those harms, largely in having a sort of center of gravity to offset China's in East Asia. This is a mainly sort of everyone but China party in the Pacific, which gives us some weight against China. So
does that include weight of the South China Sea?
Well, that's a whole different thing. I'll give you my 10-second pitch on this. So my view on China is Americans need to take it seriously without being afraid of it. Take it seriously because it affects everything that's going on, without being afraid of it because they have so many more problems than we do, and it's worth living with them as opposed to fighting against them. One way to live with them is to draw a line in the South China Sea. Over the last 2 or 3 years under the new president Xi Jinping, the military is becoming more and more sort of elbows out of just asserting its Lebensraum in the South China Sea. And every other country in that area, Japan, Vietnam, South Korea, even implicitly North Korea, Indonesia, Malaysia, they all think this is disturbing the status quo. So I think it's important for the U.S. to say, we're going to keep sailing our ships through there. We want to deal with you economically. We don't want to fight, but let's understand how things stand in the South China Sea.
Well, speaking about drawing lines, it's supposed to have been a line drawn in Syria, and right now we're trying to figure out, I suppose, to what extent we can deconflict with Russia. I mean, how do you see it?
My starting premise here is that there are times when the United States, obviously, the United States has the most powerful military the world has ever seen, which means that it needs to be careful in how it uses it. And over the last dozen years, I think we have erred on the side of getting into wars that we could not win. I put both Afghanistan and Iraq in that category. I would have been in favor of a quick punitive raid in Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks and not invading Iraq. And I think
that's include Vietnam maybe too.
Yes. Well, that would be obviously the granddaddy of them all, although I would argue that Iraq was a bigger unforced error for the United States than Vietnam. Vietnam did more damage. So the we were talking earlier about the horror of the gun situation. I think Syria is a similar situation. It is a horror for which I've not seen a less horrible scenario involving U.S. troops. And so it is how we have – what is the least hideous outcome there? I've not been persuaded that there will be a reduction in hideousness, including for us, if U.S. troops were involved. The Russians may be teaching themselves that lesson now, as they did in Afghanistan back in the 1980s.
Would Assad continuing in power be maybe the less horrible option, even though this – country has appropriately condemned his human rights violations and the horror and torture of his regime?
It is possible. It is possible. That it is one of the disturbing realist lessons of the last decade in the Middle East is that tyrants are bad when they're in power, and sometimes it can be even worse when they're not in power. And the United States for the preceding decades had been scolded by its own people internationally and internationally too for tolerating these tyrants. And the argument was, that's the evil we know. We don't know the other evil. So as you mentioned, I worked for Jimmy Carter long ago, former president of the United States, as a speechwriter. I think the effective part of it. I'll tell you after the break. I'll tell you about.
Okay, and I want to actually. Trump has been saying that we were better off with dictators in the Middle East. We can talk maybe about the presidential election. Talking about a whole range of things with Jim Fallows, and you're invited to join us. You know, whether you want to talk about the mass shootings or the high speed rail or the recent trade deal, whatever's on your mind, join the conversation. Our toll free number is 866-733-6786. I'd like to hear your thoughts as well and any questions you might have for James Fallows. 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As a national correspondent for The Atlantic, James Fallows often focuses on the international stage, subjects such as China, the Middle East, the United States military. But recently, since he grew up in California, though born in Pennsylvania, he's turned his attention to his home state, and California is indeed his home state. And he's with us to talk about, well, a number of issues, infrastructure decisions facing California, high-speed rail. We mentioned water distribution. We've been talking really about, as I said, a range of topics, including international affairs, of which he is always illuminating in discussing. And we went to a break, and you were about
talking about Carter's human rights policy. Yeah. And here is the point I was going to make, that Jimmy Carter, I think a very effective speech that Carter delivered was in Notre Dame in 1977. I was involved in that. I was writing that speech about the way to advance human rights policy. And the point he made is you can't be absolute about it because it's an imperfect world and you're going to have to deal with people you don't like. But if you're always at least trying, you will come out in a different direction than if you just say to hell with it. If you say, well, there's lots of dictators, we can't do anything, that will be worse than saying there's lots of dictators, we have to deal with some of them, but let's have a sense of where we are going. You'll have a different result. And I think that stands up over time.
Well, two quick questions. Do you think he was right on Afghanistan with respect to the Olympics?
I think that it probably he
boycotted the Olympics,
yes,
because of Russian involvement in Afghanistan.
Yes, for many listeners not alive at that time, the Olympics were going to be held in Moscow in 1980. Carter made the very unpopular at the time decision after the Russian invasion to cancel U.S. participation, which led to the Russian-Soviet boycott of the L.A. Olympics four years later. He was under a lot of pressure to seem stronger than he was seen as being too weak, and so this is a way he could seem strong. I haven't thought about that in 30-plus years. Probably he did the right thing.
Well, it seems like President Obama has similar sentiments, but when the leader of China was here, he seemed to back off anything about human rights with China.
I think that the United States I've had some view of the ongoing relationships between U.S. and Chinese governments. I've actually talked with President Obama a number of times about this privately, about the Chinese situation. I think he has a clear view of the long game that's going on in China, where they recognize they have to evolve their political system if they want to become a modern country and not just a big sweatshop. But for the last two or three years under Xi Jinping has been almost all tightening up. And the question is this two or three – is this the new normal or is this a sort of temporary phase? And the United States, I think, cannot pretend that it can just cut off dealings with China. That we tried that for 30 years and it didn't go anywhere. So I'm sure that the discussion with Xi Jinping and Obama involved a lot of these issues.
We had a lot of debates about the Iran agreement, such as it is. And I have a feeling, you tell me, where are you on it?
I have a clear view on this, which is that it is good for the United States, good for the world, and good for Iran that this deal went through. And I think you could see this even in the cynical way that opponents of the bill crafted the congressional action on it, because the congressional action, which the Republicans agreed to, was set up in a way that it was almost certain to go through. The Republicans would have to have a 2/3 majority in both houses to beat it, to override a veto, which they knew they couldn't do, barring exceptional circumstances. So it was crafted so that it could become one more way to demagogue against the president, but knowing it was still going to take effect. And the fact that essentially every nuclear expert – well, the fact that there's no other country in the world except the United States and Israel where it's even controversial shows something about the fact that its merits were recognized by all of our allies.
As a diplomatic channel, if nothing else. But, you know, the other argument is all this money that's going to Iran now to help foment Hezbollah and Hamas and, well, organizations that are certainly labeled and described as terrorists.
The argument that the Obama people, again, to me, convincingly made is this deal was about addressing the genuine existential issue of another nuclear weapon in the hands of the Iranians, which was bad for everyone, bad on non-proliferation grounds. That is what it was supposed to do. Everything else can be dealt with on other fronts, but this is the best way to reduce, defer, and hopefully, one hopes in the long run, prevent Iran ever going this direction.
Let's go to your phone calls. Nick, we begin with you. Nick wants to talk about the TPP. Go ahead, Nick.
Hey, guys. I wanted to ask Mr. Fallows what his thoughts were on the implications for entrepreneurs. He's written in the past about electronics companies and even hardware accelerators like Casey's PCH here in San Francisco. I wanted to get his thoughts on what he thought the implications of the TPP would be on the startup community.
That is a good question, and having expressed myself in detail on a number of fronts, I'll be quick to point out when I don't know enough to give a good answer. I don't know of any terms that are specifically either good or bad for entrepreneurs here. I think that to the extent that I think the natural dynamics of U.S.-Pacific trade now are favoring locally based U.S. entrepreneurs. This next stage of manufacturing, as you mentioned, Liam, Casey, and PCH and Highway 1 and all the rest, it does have a relatively greater premium for those who can be close to developed markets, who can make prototypes quickly and all the rest. I'm not aware of anything in the deal that would make that either easier or harder, but to the extent it promotes trade in general, I think it would be a good background situation, and that's the best I can do.
Nick, we thank you for the call. Let me go right to another caller in Berkeley. Harvey, you're on.
Hello, Michael, and hello, Jim. I think that there's the possibility of getting what you want, running the high-speed rail and saving water at the same time, because it turns out that the High-Speed Rail Authority is committed to using 100% renewable energy to power the system, and the rail would run through the Central Valley right next to the California Aqueduct System, and the 700-mile California Aqueduct System, they can cover appropriate sections with solar panels, like a solar panel photovoltaic canopy or an awning, and it turns out that once manufactured and installed, solar panels use no water over their 20 to 25 year warranty, and also help keeping the water in the canals. It would keep it from what they call evapotranspiration. It would slow evaporation, keep the water cleaner, cooler, and it's all around. So the electricity from California's solar-powered aqueduct system can power the high-speed rail system through California and save water while doing it.
So I have heard presentations to that effect, and that sounds good and promising to me. And the generalized point I'd make from it is that a lot of the big advances the U.S. and the world have made in technological capability, they've come, of course, from challenges and problems like the current water and energy challenges, but they've also come from big public undertakings, which have spill-off benefits in a lot of ways. The internet, of course, was a big Defense Department initiative back in the 1960s. Aviation and aerospace in general is not just the moon program, but 50 years before that of the government sponsoring the idea of travel. And so I think that I have a bias in favor of big, ambitious public infrastructure, non-military infrastructure of this sort for the kinds of spinoffs that you mentioned. So I've heard that, too. I agree, and I'll look forward to seeing it happen.
Well, I've got an email here from – or actually somebody on our website. Ben writes, what about new forms of desalination, and how's the current San Diego plant working out?
I don't know enough about the San Diego plant to comment. The barrier with desalinization, of course, is the energy intensity it requires. So I was interviewing former Vice President Gore a couple of days ago in D.C. for an article I have coming out in The Atlantic very soon. And he was saying that his view on climate issues in general is a combination of truly dire warnings and ominousness, but also great optimism about the pace of technological solutions, or at least fixes, has been going much more quickly than anyone suspected. And so he said that solar energy has come down so much more rapidly in price than anybody foresaw, that this would be the thing which potentially would make desalinization plants practical. Of course, when that works, or when fusion motors work or whatever, power plants, that will be a whole different terrain.
As I said, Jim, getting a lot of pushback on high-speed rail. Let me just give you an example here. Richard from San Francisco writes, have to disagree strongly with your guest. It is still the train of nowhere. It is a boondoggle, but that is so because it is using outdated technology. Hardly will be viable 50 years from now, as your guest posits. China has maglev trains that go almost twice as fast as the already outmoded design of this train, and it will only crawl down the San Francisco Peninsula because the towns there will not agree to a high-speed right-of-way. And to compare it to the Panama Canal, right, if the Panama Canal traversed only half the distance between the oceans.
I will, rather than consume the next 4 hours of airtime, I will respectfully refer the reader to the 15-part, 10,000-word series in the Atlantic site going into all these arguments. The maglev issue, I actually have ridden aboard the maglev trains in China. I'm not sure if the listener has. The one in Shanghai is impressive for the 12 miles that it runs from the Shanghai airport to not quite connecting to the Shanghai subway system. There are some much more developed ones in Japan. There is a long and detailed engineering argument about the practicalities of maglev versus conventional propulsion. The argument from the High Speed Rail Authority is that for the foreseeable future, the propulsion they're going with is the practical one that you can actually build with now, that if you keep chasing the technology that is 6 months away, you'll never actually build it. So I'll turn to the 15-part series beyond that.
Well, here's David from Berkeley who says, what does your guest think of the Hyperloop technology that Elon Musk, who trashes high-speed rail, is proposing? In my opinion, it's a very exciting idea, but it won't be ready for a very long time. Its proponents don't realize how stringent the safety regulations will be on a tube filled with passengers hurtling 750 miles per hour.
I'm a big fan of Elon Musk. I've interviewed him a number of times, written about him in the magazine, and I agree. This is a great thing, like flying cars when it happens. Maybe
you almost said self-driving cars.
Self-driving cars will happen. Flying cars, yeah. Even though I'm an aviation,
self-driving cars are here. Yeah,
they are here, and I imagine 10 years from now there'll be a dominant sort of local transportation mean a way to connect rail stations to where people are actually getting going. So the Hyperloop is exciting. I don't think Elon Musk would say it's sort of within timely reach for a California answer.
Don from Mountain View writes, thanks for another interesting interview. Thank you, Don. And he goes on to say, about your guest's comments on high-speed rail, it would be helpful for this project if the project managers would provide accurate and realistic projections for cost, ridership, and community impact. It would also help if they would demonstrate flexibility by ending the service in San Jose, not San Francisco. The existing San Francisco-San Jose corridor makes actual high-speed impossible, not to mention the destruction of thriving downtown areas in Mountain View, Palo Alto, Menlo Park, San Mateo, and Burlingame.
I'm going to defer here because any answer I would give would be second or third hand. You should have Dan Richard on the show once again, the chairman of the authority, who he's been on.
Yeah.
You can have one again. So I know these are sort of asked and answered issues. I recognize this is the reason you want to start earlier rather than later on these projects, because any infrastructure involves real time disruptions. Now the question is, 50 years from now, what will mean if you do it versus not doing it?
Another listener wants to know your opinion on the Delta Tunnel project, same as high-speed rail?
I'm going to here's the way I'll avoid answering that, because this is one I have not looked into enough to really answer. I'll say that in Washington, D.C., where I live on the northwest half of town, which is where Georgetown University is, the nicer houses are. 30 years ago, the rest of the city decided to have a metro service, and the northwest part of town said, no, no metro for us. It will disrupt our neighborhoods. Now the worst part of our part of town is there's no metro there, and the rest of the city is growing because of metro connections. And I use this as an analogy for non-military infrastructure in general. Delta Tunnel, I'm going to refer to your Delta Tunnel experts.
Okay. Here's a nice note from Mike from Berkeley.
It's about time.
I very much enjoyed breaking the news. What your book on the same subject would look like in these troubled political times where media is in everybody's pocket added to my enjoyment of the book. I very much miss you on NPR, a system that has turned away from commentary as it has grown large for corporate America. Thank you for writing about California. We are watched, made fun of, envied, and followed. Interesting that we can be a liberal state and we can elect very conservative people, too. You know, a lot of people are regretting that Jerry Brown, who has proven to be pretty good in his recent governorship in many people's eyes, is not putting his eyes toward the presidency. Of course, his age is a major factor. But can we talk about the presidency for a moment? What do you make about the Trump phenomenon?
I'll say first a word about Jerry Brown. I'm an admirer of his, especially in this latest reincarnation as governor. I did a big story in The Atlantic about 2 years ago explaining why I thought he showed the value of actually caring about politics. And he was so I'll leave it there. The Trump phenomenon, I will still bet anyone any amount of money he is not going to be president, and I'll still take long odds he's not going to be the Republican nominee. It's no surprise, I guess, that he's doing as well as he is this far, even though I was surprised. I thought he would have faded Herman Cain-like or Michelle Bachmann-like by this point, because for a couple of decades, he's been a TV entertainer. He presents himself as a businessman, but his business has been reality shows, and he's really entertaining. I like listening to him. He's fun to listen to. And I think there's a kind of spontaneous what's going to happen next version to his appeal. I think he is terrible news for the Republican Party, because every impulse he's drawing on, especially the anti-immigrant impulse, anti-Hispanic impulse, means their nominee is in terrible trouble. But it's
not going to be him, in your judgment.
It's not going to be him, and he's not going to be president.
Hillary Clinton going to be the nominee of the Democrats?
You would have to say that based on the odds. And there's a from her campaign's point of view, there's a good news way and a bad news way to interpret the sort of lack of – the apparent lack of enthusiasm for her at this point. The good news way is there have been no Democratic debates. People are bored with the idea of an anointed or seemingly anointed candidate. And so there's just the story has – there has to be some kind of challenge. So Bernie Sanders is a challenge. Joe Biden is a – will he do it or not? Martin O'Malley might stage some kind of surprise third-place finish in Iowa, et cetera. That would be the good news, that when it gets serious, people will come to her. The bad news is that maybe there's something that people just are not enthusiastic about with her. That obviously would be a breakthrough for women around the world, or at least in the United States, since other countries have had women leaders. But somehow there's it seems to be a lack of passion for her that she would like to see more of.
So, and a lack of trust, at least according to recent polls.
That's lack of trust. I personally think this email controversy does seem to me like the Whitewater controversy 20 years ago about both of the Clintons, in that it's an ongoing scandal, in air quotes, where you have a hard time defining what the actual scandal is. That Mitt Romney erased all of his emails after he was governor of Massachusetts. Jeb Bush has had very few of his emails released. Well, he did a lot of emails, but some of them have been sequestered. Colin Powell hasn't released any of his emails as Secretary of State. It was a perhaps foolish thing for her to do, but I don't see this as an ongoing front page trust issue in the New York Times and elsewhere.
I want to go to more of your calls. Let me go first to some comments here about Fresno. John writes, "Hooray, Fresno. Thank you, Jim, for singing its praises. I grew up in a small Central Valley town near Fresno, and I'm not surprised that there is a growing local arts movement there, and also that our recent National Poet Laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera, is from the Central Valley. There is a certain serenity and ephemeral quality, if that makes sense, to the atmosphere out there. I hope to get to one of those downtown art fairs sometime soon, preferably on some foggy winter evening." And Julia writes, "I grew up in Fresno and thought it to be an idyllic experience. I watched the renovation of the downtown area, which in a way broke my heart because the old downtown was vital, and as teenagers we loved to drag the main. However, 40 years ago I moved to San Francisco Bay Area and felt like I came home. I recently attended my 55th high school reunion and took a tour of the places I had lived in Fresno and was surprised to find two of those residencies for sale at prices which I could afford to pay cash." Let me go to some more calls here, and we'll go to Wynn in Menlo Park. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you. For years, corporate management has been hamstrung by investors who are insisting on 90-day horizons for earnings, and therefore have they had to cut back on some of their long-term developments. The same is true of government. If you look back at President Kennedy, it was probably the last major challenge in which we all got behind and tried to do something. And now, with the campaigns going on, worrying about minutia, no one is talking about long-term objectives. And what is it that we have to do to get people to stop looking at 90-day objectives and try to figure out how to run this country, because we need help?
This is a question much on my mind, both on the corporate level and the governmental level. On the corporate level, I'll say a week from now in the November issue of The Atlantic, I have an article coming out that I think you will find very interesting on this exact theme. It's about a radically sustainable and long-term approach to investment that's been tried more or less in secret over the past 10 years and has proven itself more profitable than any other short-term CNBC panic-driven hedge fund thing. So a week from now, check out the newsstands and your website. I'll leave it at that. On the public scale, I agree that part of what I'm going to talk about tonight at The Long Now is how it is people can organize themselves to do things whose rewards are beyond our immediate payoff point. During the next election, even one's personal lifetime, one's children's lifetime, those are the things that make great countries, great economies, great civilizations, and there are circumstances in which we can organize ourselves to do that. Politics at the moment is more hostile to that than it has usually been. I think there is room, especially on the Republican side, for somebody making a positive case. You know, Ronald Reagan, he had his stern times, but he was not an angry guy. He was a sort of optimistic-sounding guy. So I think the next popular president is going to be somebody who says, yes, we know things are going poorly, but we can actually do things. Trump is tapping some of this when he says, oh, we're going to win so often you're going to get bored of winning. That's a kind of stupid version of the long-term vision that embraces these kinds of projects.
Did you get your question answered, Wynn?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. This is more of a comment maybe, but let me read it. A listener writes, I agree completely with Mr. Fallows that infrastructure projects take incredible amounts of unreasoning flack. It bothers me the most when it comes from supposed fiscal conservatives. Don't people know that infrastructure projects are an investment? Infrastructure improvements are a major consideration for those considering opening businesses here. Every business owner considers, are there good roads? And no business owner wants to come somewhere where the bridges and roads are going to collapse under them. Come on, California and America. Don't get stupid about this, or should I say, don't remain stupid about this.
I say right on.
This is actually a tweet from Francis, who says, talking again about responsibility in journalism, we were talking about not including the name of some of these school shooters or homegrown killers or whatever you want to call them. I hope others will follow the lead. But newspapers are publishing the names. And, I mean, do you come down on this one way or the other?
I think it's an impossible – it would be impossible to expect newspapers of record not to include the person's name because they would be – I think there are degrees of sensationalization of whether – so, for example, after some shootings, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, cable news in particular would have big features of the person, his name, all saying his because it always is a man and his life story. I think one can include the name as part of the public record, which I think is an obligation of news organizations, but not celebrate it, not give the person sort of the Lee Harvey Oswald effect. All of us know the name Lee Harvey Oswald. Some of us know the name James Earl Ray, who shot Martin Luther King. But I think one of the goals is that for hideous reasons, there's so many of these shootings, they run together, but also for sort of emphasis reasons, we don't celebrate the name in that same graven in stone way.
Again, on Roseburg, Mike writes, parallels between the Roseburg killer and the Newtown killer, Newton killer, were striking. Disturbed young man living with a divorced mother who shielded him from the world, collected firearms, and whose chief recreation was taking him to the shooting range.
Yes, there seems to be a lot of similarities in how these disturbed young men take it out on the world.
David in Berkeley writes, I think it's very disingenuous for politicians on the right now to offer support for the mentally ill instead of gun control. These people never gave an iota about the suffering of the mentally ill before, and now they are only interested in the issue to protect the rest of us so-called mentally healthy citizens.
And as a matter of fact, almost everybody who would vote against gun control measures also votes to decrease federal funding for mental health efforts. So that is factually correct.
Muhammad on our website writes, is he the same James Fallows who wrote National Defense? If so, yes, he is.
Yes, I am.
Won the National Book Award, in fact. I'd like to know his views about F-35 and the future of the U.S. defense.
I wrote a long cover story in The Atlantic earlier this year called The Tragedy of the American Military, which was essentially an extension of my national defense argument from the early 1980s to the military of today. The point I talked about the F-35 there, the main point I was making is that the United States has become a chicken hawk culture. We are a country that is always at war, that is known around the rest of the world for our military presence, our drone strikes, and all the rest, but which most of the overwhelming majority of us are not at war. Everybody who served in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last dozen years combined come to less than 1% of the population. It's, you know, everybody in that time. And so people salute the troops and get on the airplanes first, but pay no serious attention to our military. I think the F-35 is a symptom of that. It's a – we could have 20 shows on why this plane – the cost overruns for this plane alone are 100 times greater than the entire funding for Solyndra. And Solyndra got 100 times the press or the outrage commentary.
What about your sentiment when Trump comes down very hard on John McCain for not helping vets enough? I mean, is that legitimate? McCain has voted against some legislation for veterans.
And what he came down on him was for being a loser. you know, that Trump liked people who didn't get caught.
And right. He was a prisoner of war, therefore he was
yes.
a loser, right?
Yeah. And I was a sign that something unusual was going on with the Trump campaign where he didn't have to resign the next day from the campaign for calling McCain a loser for having been shot down over Vietnam. So McCain, I have my agreements and disagreements with, but to call him an enemy of veterans is preposterous.
Skip writes, how do you plan for water distribution given the stark reality of California's large and growing thirsty human population?
This is the question that Governor Brown, that the universities, that the cities and everybody else are dealing with. If this drought persists, California in its current form will not be sustainable. So that is the challenge for California. If the drought goes on, something will change, and that is the reality we're all coping with.
And another water-related question, but actually Kurt wants to know about the Keystone. He says, I don't understand why Keystone was not proposed as a double-barreled pipeline, one channel for oil and a second for water. After all, Canada does have the water, and they would be happy to sell it to us just as they are happy to sell us the oil.
Not to talk about Keystone, but to talk about water distribution in general, the eastern half of the country is wetter than ever. You've seen the floods in South Carolina, which Michelle Bachmann blamed on an angry Jehovah. But, you know, there's not a shortage of water in the entire United States. There's a maldistribution of water, and it's getting across the Rockies. East of the Rockies, there's a ton of water. West of the Rockies, there isn't. So that's the challenge.
Mark writes, love to hear Mr. Fallows' thoughts on income and wealth inequality. Is it a problem? And if so, what are the solutions? Of course it's a problem. Do you have any solutions, Jim?
Of course the problem. It's the problem in the United States. It's a problem worldwide. The answers are partly economic, commercial, and technological, of sort of fostering the kinds of jobs and growth that can create more of these middle jobs. And we've written often in our series about the role of community colleges, which I think are the most important American educational institutions now, and tech education trying to do this. But since this is happening everywhere in the world, the answers are largely political as well. Distribution of wealth. The distribution of income in the United States after taxes is now less equal than it is before taxes. The tax situation is making things worse because they've been cut so much for capital gains income and at the higher end. So simply having a fairer tax system would be a start.
I know you got another book on the way somewhere, but it was great having you on without a book because we can range all over the place, and we did, and I appreciate that. Always a delight to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Michael. It's a real pleasure to be here.
James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, author of China Airborne. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we encourage you to continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And remind you that we will be back with you on the morrow. We're going to be talking tomorrow to Anne-Marie Slaughter, who has a book, Unfinished Business, all about work and family for women, much of it from her own experience. She wrote an article saying, no, women can't have it all. And boy, there was an extraordinary response to that. We certainly encourage your responses. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. And Forum is produced by Tina Larberg, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.